Dr. Yanis Votsis is a philosopher of science specializing in structural realism. He is the co-director of the Düsseldorf Center for Logic and Philosophy of Science at the University of Düsseldorf in Germany, a center mainly researching the principles of meta-induction. Yanis, before we get to the intricate details of structural realism, it's appropriate to start with the general overviews of realism and its accompanying debates in philosophy of science.
Let me try and, to reach a broader audience, try and simplify the basics of this debate about realism so that non-philosophers can understand it. I mean, the debate about scientific realism is a debate about the limits of scientific knowledge. It's not about, not as opposed to kind of non-scientific knowledge. So what can science teach us and what can, you know, I don't know, religion or whatever, something like that teaches us. That's not what we're interested in the scientific realism debate. When we say the limits of scientific knowledge, we mean as opposed to what we cannot know altogether, right? So either you know it through science or you don't know it. Now, realists typically claim that scientific theories reveal, like successful scientific theories reveal more of the world to us than the anti-realists, what they call anti-realists. I want to emphasize, I'm putting it very neutrally here, and there's a point I'm trying to make, and I'm going to get to it in a few seconds. Now, nobody claims that our current best scientific theories reveal the world to us in all its details. Absolutely nobody says that. We all know that even our best scientific theories, relativity theory and quantum mechanics, they don't really reveal everything there is to reveal about the world. They get some things not quite right. So we know that there's a theory out there beyond these theories, right, that corrects them, does better, and perhaps does best. Also, nobody, I don't think any serious philosopher at any rate, claims that these scientific theories reveal nothing of the world to us, right? So the truth is somewhere in between, that the scientific theories reveal something of the world to us. And both realists and anti-realists make positive and negative claims about what can be known. Now, notice the way I define this whole debate. So the realists say that we know more about the world through our scientific theories than the anti-realists, but I haven't really said where do we draw the line. And the reason I haven't said that is because I think that there is no correct answer to this question. The line is drawn arbitrarily, in a sense, right? It's a matter of convention. So here's where convention comes in. What matters is not whether you call yourself a realist or an anti-realist at the end of the day. What matters is whether the positive claims you make about our knowledge and the negative claims you make about them are the most defensible, the most warranted. So in that respect, I'm a bit dismissive of the way the debate is conducted. But at the same time, I don't want to dismiss the view that there are better or worse views out there. It's just that the label realist and anti-realist, realism and anti-realism, is not really that appropriate. At this point, it might be useful, I guess, to tell you, like, give you two arguments that seem to point in different directions, right? So they give you, one gives you more realism, the other gives you less realism, in a sense, right? So I'm not sure if you've heard of this argument before, the no miracles argument. So let's just forget about calling it no miracles argument. Let's just call it, it's sort of a inference from success to truth. It's an argument for positive claims about knowledge. So you say something like, we can inductively infer the truth or the partial truth of a theory or a theory part from its success in accounting for or explaining or success in predicting or even retrodicting various phenomena. So again, we consider our best scientific theories to have some truth content at least. Why? Because they have a lot of success in explaining, predicting, retrodicting phenomena. Now, this is the argument that leans towards kind of the positive side. The argument that leans towards the negative side, or supports negative claims about knowledge, that we don't have such knowledge, right, is a sort of historical argument. It's called the pessimistic meta-induction argument. And according to this argument, inferences from success to truth or partial truth fail because predictively successful theories in the past have turned out to be false, right? And their central posits we now think to be corresponding to nothing real. So there are examples like the phlogiston theory of combustion, the caloric theory of heat, wave theory of light based on an ether, right? Even Newtonian physics. Okay, so this is my spiel for scientific realism in a nutshell, right? The debate.
Thanks for that concise yet detailed summary of the realist debate in philosophy of science. Now moving on slightly from this and in terms of an extended version of the classical realist and contemporary realist debates in philosophy of science is the school of thought, which is structural realism.
So in order to answer the question, what is structural realism? First of all, we need to answer the question of what is structure, right? Because there's always confusion about what it is that we're going to be realists about, what the structure thing is, right? So now there is disagreement about how exactly to conceive of structures, but the most widespread conception, agreed upon conception, is a set theoretic one. So according to this conception, a structure consists of two things. One, a non-empty set of objects. We can call this a domain of the structure. And two, a set of relations, which means basically a set of ordered and tuples. So a set of ordered objects defined on that domain. So what is structural realism? Well, roughly speaking, it's really very rough. It's the view that our knowledge of the world is at best a knowledge of its structure. So the objects are known only insofar as they play a role in the structure, but no more. Or if you want to, we can put it otherwise. We can say we can only describe the world up to isomorphism. So, and there are two main strands of this view. One is more modest, and it's kind of the epistemic strand. According to this strand, there may be something to an object that goes beyond the relations or structures it enters into. If that's the case, then that something is forever unknown to us. The ontic or more radical view of structural realism says that there's nothing other than structure. So it says something like the world itself is nothing but objectless structure. So objects are something like mere nodes in a structure, nothing more than that. Of course, there are subtle variations for both the epistemic and the ontic accounts, but I don't think we have time to get into these subtle variations. So I leave those behind.
Now, clearly, you have expertise in structural realism, as your very interesting paper, Is Structure Not Enough?, addresses. But in terms of the application of structural realism, some would say that all that matters in terms of the study of realism, reality, and science is this aspect of structure, which allows us to produce explanatory, causal, and predictive models. Others would say that structure is not enough because in this respect all we can study in terms of what constitutes reality and realism is the structure that is pinned to a notion of realism. Therefore, we may never be able to fully understand what reality is, with a capital R per se, only some of the structural elements of what we constitute reality as. How do you see some of these positions fitting in with the realist, anti-realist debate and structural realism?
The main argument for structural realism, I mean, there's a bunch of different arguments. I wrote a very long piece, Critical Survey of the Literature, with Roman Frigg of LSE, where we mentioned a bunch of these arguments. But the main argument is the argument from the history of science. So as I mentioned earlier, there's an argument that leans more towards the negative side of things, which is the so-called pessimistic meta-induction argument. And it says, again, that inferences from success to partial truth are not good. Why? Because predictively successful theories in the past have turned out to be false, right? Now, one counter-argument to this pessimistic meta-induction is that not everything is lost in the wake of a scientific revolution. So, in fact, so long as the parts of past theories that yielded the successes of those theories get preserved in successor theories, then nothing of value is lost, right? Because you don't lose any of that. Remember, the realist or the positive argument is that you go from success to truth, right? You infer from success to truth inductively, of course, right? Without guarantee, but still inductively. It's an inductively strong argument, right? So if that's what you care about, from success to truth, then if the parts of the old theories that were successful never get lost, they get preserved in the new theories, they somehow get incorporated as parts of the new theories, then there's nothing really of value that gets lost, right? The only thing that was of value was exactly those parts. We know that our theories, any theories we have, even today's theories, are not going to have all their parts, are not going to be true, right? We do know that because we know that they're not perfect, right? They don't make perfect corrections. So something must be at fault. So something must be given up in the next scientific revolution, for sure. But so long as the stuff that actually does produce the success gets preserved, then there is no real problem, right? And the structural realists say that the stuff that gets preserved is actually the structural stuff, and not all the structure, in fact. It's just the structure that produces the results, the success of the theory. So a very well-known example that the structural realists discuss is Fresnel's wave theory of light. According to this theory, I mean, this theory tries to explain reflection and refraction at an interface. So at an interface between air, for example, and water, right? So what happens to reflection and refraction there? And it predicts it quite well. The problem with this theory was that it was dependent on this posit of the ether. But the fact is that even though the ether has been given up, the basic structure of light, as it's captured by the equations of this theory and without reference to the ether, has been preserved in successor theories. So we can derive Fresnel's equations from Maxwell's mature theory of electromagnetism, and we expect that any successor theory is going to have to incorporate those results as well. So this is the main argument for the structural realists. So this would give some credence towards the idea that it's only structure that we know and no more, right?
So, for example, if the theories behind some of this stuff may shift, but we maintain a structure, say something from gravity, from Newton to Einstein, in terms of, obviously, it's changed a bit in terms of how it's now incorporated into space-time, but the structure is still there, per se. That's a reasonably good demonstration.
Well, at some limit form, it's still there, right? It's not. You don't have to derive things exactly as they are before, simply because if your theory before didn't make perfect predictions, and no theory probably does, no theory we have available, if it makes only predictions that are only accurate up to some extent, then you wouldn't expect the successor theory, if it's better than the previous theory, if it's more accurate, to be strictly consistent with the old theory. It would have to correct it a little bit. So then we'd start talking about correspondence in some limit form, right? So the old and the new theory correspond, but in some limit form.
Now, in terms of the possibility of structure not being enough, let's take some of the considerations from structural realism, which is some things may change in terms of scientific theories, but all in all, throughout scientific progression, the structure remains the same. Of course, one area here which confronts this kind of conceptual framework would be something perhaps like Thomas Kuhn, the paradigm shift, which is, even if we're going to try to maintain the structure in which theories can change but the structure remains the same, there is a problem when we shift the paradigm, because certain concepts can't be carried over. Therefore, it's hard to maintain this structure when we can't even have conceptual continuation. We need to move from one paradigm to another, and this then causes problems if we think we can still maintain the structure, when really concepts, theories, and causal explanations have actually shifted in terms of paradigm perspectives. What are some of your thoughts on this, Yanis?
Let me try and separate those two issues and start first of all with Kuhn, and then end up by saying something about structure not being enough. Okay, so Kuhn presents a primitive version of this pessimistic meta-induction argument, right? Kuhn is at times is not as clear as somebody like Loudon, who's the author of the pessimistic meta-induction argument. So sometimes you read Kuhn and you think that he wants to say that really the world has literally changed from one paradigm to the other. At other times you read him and you think that the changes are definitely some radical changes, but it's not that the world has changed itself, right? Now, as I said, even the structural realist can admit that there are all sorts of changes, but the question is whether these changes are changes of things that matter, right? So if there are any of those parts of theories that contribute to the success of the theory, actively contribute to the success of the theory, get thrown away, get abandoned in the wake of a scientific revolution. And if that's not the case, then of course there's nothing to fear about. So even in the cases of phlogiston, in fact, there's a paper that I co-authored with the director of the center I'm working at here, the Düsseldorf Center for Logic and Philosophy of Science, of which I am the assistant director. And we actually have two studies. One of them is on the phlogiston theory of combustion and the other one on the caloric theory of heat. And in both cases, we try and show that even though the posits of phlogiston and caloric have been overthrown, there is some respect in which part of the structure of those theories has been preserved. Right? So, for example, according to the caloric theory of heat, caloric particles repulse one another, so they can't stand each other's face. Right? So when you add caloric or heat to a body, these caloric particles get attracted to ordinary particles. But if there's a lot of them, a lot of the caloric particles, then they start pushing against each other. And that creates a body to expand, right? So that's why when we heat an object, we're adding caloric to it and it expands. If we do the opposite, if we remove the heat from the object, that means that there are less caloric particles in the being crowded in the object. And that means that, of course, the object can contract. The volume needed is smaller. Now, even though the caloric was given up, we have the kinetic theory of heat nowadays. And according to this theory, something similar structurally is happening there as well. So according to this conception of heat, the modern conception of heat, heat is something like kinetic energy. It's an instance of kinetic energy, right? So if you add heat to an object, depending on whether it's a solid or a gas or whatever it is, then what happens is that, so if it's a solid, then it makes the atoms or the particles of this body to vibrate. And this vibration, the more you add to it, the more it pushes against the boundaries of the object, and that creates an expansion. Of course, if you remove kinetic energy, that creates a contraction, right? You could say this a similar story to with gases. So if you add kinetic energy to gases, then they bounce around much more. And when they bounce around much more, more frequently and more violently with the boundaries of the object, then that body expands and it contracts if you remove the kinetic energy, right? So even though the posit in each of these cases is different, you know, we no longer believe in this substance that we call the caloric, the structure is the same. And it's obvious that it's the same, right? So in that respect, you can say that even in these extreme cases, there is structure preservation, and the structure that gets preserved is where it really matters. So that's to answer the Kuhnian concern. Now to go to the concern about whether structure is enough, there is an issue as to whether or not you can capture everything you want to capture about a target system using simply structure, right? So one might pose the following problem, for example. They might say, well, look, if structure is all you need, then what happens in cases where you have two systems and they have exactly the same structure, how do you discriminate between them? Well, there are two ways, right? So the two systems could be Coulomb's law and Newton's law. They're both inverse square laws. They have the same structure. So you might say, so how do you discriminate between these two cases if structure is all that matters? Well, there's two things. First of all, when we talk about structures, we don't talk about structures that are empirically uninterpreted. Obviously, you need to have some connections with what you can measure and what you can observe. And that makes a difference in cases where you're measuring Coulomb forces, or you're measuring gravity, right? But the other difference is that these things, these structures we're talking about, are also connected to broader structures, and that can be a discriminating feature as well. So if you look at the broader structure, you'll find that it's not identical in each of these cases. So this is one way in which one may make one such objection disappear. Doesn't mean that, of course, other objections disappear in a similar way, but that's a difficult objection that can be answered, I think.
Okay, so far, Yanis, you have given us a summary of the realist, anti-realist debate in philosophy of science and also placed this within the additional contemporary context of structural realism. And for all these different schools of thought in philosophy of science, you've given us arguments in favour and against. At this stage, what can your own insights bring to this current situation?
I'm the kind of person who thinks that philosophy should be tested. Even philosophical theories should be tested. And one of the nice things about structural realism, not just structural realism, but all sorts of these positions, is that we can actually make them stick their neck out. They can stick their neck out such that the empirical guillotine can fall on it if indeed they're saying something false. So, for example, according to the structural realist, any successor theory about electromagnetic phenomena that's strictly speaking more predictively accurate than our current theories, right, needs to incorporate the equations I talked about before, Fresnel's equations, at least in some limit form, right? So if a future theory arises from which we cannot derive Fresnel's equations, not even in some limit form, then that would basically tell us that structural realism has failed. Or if a future theory arises that doesn't merely rely on structural features of the world, that posits more than merely structure, something more primitive, right? Then we would say that structural realism doesn't get things right, right. So in that respect, it's important to see that some of these theories, and it's very important that these theories make such claims, that they stick their neck out for empirical falsification, right? So that's the thing I wanted to say about structural realism and any other position.
Great, thanks for that, Yanis. In terms of your research goals and research projects going forward, could you please elaborate on some of those?
In terms of future projects, the future is already here for me because I'm developing a new, more liberalized form of empiricism. It's a kind of empiricism that's more in tune with what scientists really think. So this is a kind of empiricism that divorces itself from traditional conceptions of experience. So it can be said that the most influential popular view of empiricism in the last 20, 30 years is Van Frassen's notion of empiricism. According to this view, science rather aims at empirically adequate theories that save all and only the observable phenomena. But what's observable for him, it's really tiny, it's very restricted. It's tied to traditional conceptions of experience, right? So what we can confirm or disconfirm with our unaided senses. But this is really absolutely horrific for scientists to hear, because especially in the natural sciences, because most of our measurements there come through instruments. So what I've been trying to do recently is to develop this notion of universal empiricism, according to which our theories aim, or at least ought to aim, at empirically complete theories or observational complete theories, where my notion of observation incorporates all sorts of instrument-mediated detection. And the main idea here is to do the following thing: to confront the doubters, the people who doubt instrument detection, and ask them the following thing. What do they think makes sensory organs so special? What makes sensory organs epistemically credible, really? Because a lot of people don't even ask this basic question. Van Frassen certainly doesn't ask this question. And if you seriously ask this question, what you'll get is something like the following. This is my answer, and I ask anybody who thinks otherwise to contact me, and I'll be very interested to hear what they have to say. So if what makes sensory organs epistemically credible is their ability to map things in the world, in other words, it's their ability, let me break this down a little bit, it's their ability to identify and re-identify the same objects or sufficiently similar objects in the world under sufficiently similar circumstances, and to discriminate between objects under sufficiently similar circumstances, right? And not being able to discriminate all the differences in the world, of course, but at least some of them, right? But also to use the output we get from the sensory organs, the perceptions we get, right, to successfully interact with and predict the world, if that's what makes them epistemically credible, then they need not look anywhere else to find exactly the same epistemic credibility. It's basically what instruments do. Instruments produce sufficiently similar output in the presence of sufficiently similar input, right? And under, you know, normal conditions, let's say, as well as produce sufficiently dissimilar output in the presence of sufficiently dissimilar input within certain ranges, right? And we can use the output of these instruments to basically successfully interact and predict the world. So this is what, so instruments do exactly the same job, and sometimes they do it even better than we do with our sensory organs. So we need to accept this broader notion of observability into our epistemology. And the final thing I'd like to say about this notion of a universal empiricism is that it allows us also to have some kind of measure against which we can compare what happens in different, if we could ever meet different epistemic communities in the universe, right? We could compare how much progress each has made towards the common goal, science, right? Science, as it is understood as a bare bones goal, the bare bones goal to produce these observationally complete theories, right? So we're all looking for these observationally complete theories. And if our instruments, all of our instruments work in exactly the same way, namely, what I mean by this, not, of course, there could be different instruments, but they satisfy these principles that I just mentioned, right? That they produce sufficiently similar output in the presence of sufficiently similar input, that they produce sufficiently dissimilar output in the presence of sufficiently dissimilar input within a given range of inputs, and that they can be used to successfully their output can be used to successfully interact and predict the world, then we should expect that output from instruments that they use should agree with the output of our instruments. And we can then make comparisons and say, you know, there has been, there has been this progress in our community as opposed to this progress and so forth.